general political historical situation at the time of Christ into which he was born. And it's an extremely complicated and messy and dirty kind of political situation. I think one of the most remarkable things about the birth of Christ is when it happened. And we have so many nice, neat, clean, well-organized ideas about Christmas and about the birth of Christ, you know, and everything just kind of went off like clockwork, except, you know, that they lost the hotel reservation when they got to Bethlehem and they had to stay out and back, you know. But other than that, the angels showed right up on schedule and the shepherds came in, you know, and everything sort of seemed like it went like clockwork. If, you know, we could play God for a few minutes and had our druthers on when we'd want to be born, I suspect that one time, very obviously, when we wouldn't want to be born is when Jesus was born. And the political situation, the economic situation, the whole business, you know, couldn't have been much worse than it was. I suppose it would maybe have been one time a little bit worse than when he did come. And that was maybe 6 months after the Babylonian captivity, when most of the Jews had been transported to Babylon. But it was a very bad time, and I'm going to do my best to try to make it as clear for you as I can. Now, in order to, whenever you're talking about a historical situation, you always got to take a running jump on it and start a bit before the time you're going to talk about it. And so we're going to have to start about 4th century B.C. in the time of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was king of Macedonia, which was the country to the north of the Greek city-states. He conquered the Greek city-states, moved across the Hellespont, conquered Asia Minor, moved down south, conquered Syria, Palestine, Egypt, headed farther and farther east. I got to do it backwards so it looks right for you. Headed farther and farther east into the area of India, went as far as the Indus River, went down as far south as the Indian Ocean, came back up, and at 33 years of age, he died. Now, he had conquered all of the world, all of the civilized world that was known to him. Lands to the west of Greece, Italy and Sicily and that kind of area weren't considered particularly civilized. Their time was to come a couple centuries later. But he had conquered the whole area. And what he left, while he didn't live long enough to consolidate his territory, what he left was two things, both of which are extremely important for the coming of Christianity. One is, he created a common Hellenistic cultural base for the civilized world. Now, Hellenistic is late or decadent Hellenic culture. Hellenic culture is Greek culture. This is later culture, mixture of Near Eastern and Grecian ideas. It had its effect in sculpture, music, painting, mosaics, architecture, and views about life. By virtue of having conquered the whole cultured world, and leaving it under control of Macedonian Greeks, he created a common cultural base, a common basis for people to understand one another, so that if people from two different cultures met one another, they had a common Hellenistic cultural base into which they could plug in order to understand one another. The second thing which he left, which was even more important in the Hellenistic culture, was a very rich and expressive language, which we today call Koine Greek or Common Greek, everyday Greek, which became the language of commerce, the language of everyday talk, the language of letters back and forth, and eventually the language in which the New Testament would be written. As a result of this, the cultural world to which Christ came 3 centuries later, at least in Judea, if not in Galilee, was a Hellenistic world, a world which was more Hellenistic than Jewish. In Galilee, it was more Jewish than Hellenistic. And the story of his life, his teachings, the creation of his church, and some of the early letters of communication within the church, all are preserved for us, not in the Aramaic language which Jesus spoke, but in contemporary colloquial Greek, which Alexander had spread around the world. We do have a few expressions that are Aramaic, like Rabbi, which we know in English as Rabbi, and the one word which Jesus spoke on the cross, Lama, Lama, Sabachthani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Those are the only words we possess that are actually words that Jesus literally spoke. I mean, it spoke them like that. That word on the cross, Lama, Lama, Sabachthani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Kind of interesting to speculate about why, of all the things that he said in Aramaic, that's the only Aramaic sentence that he uttered that we possess. All the rest of it is in Alexander's everyday Greek. Even though Alexander left behind him a culture and a language which would shape the Mediterranean world for at least the next 4 centuries, he did not leave an empire which remained intact. He died too soon to consolidate his gains. After his death in 312 at the age of 33, which coincidentally is the same age as Christ when Christ died, his empire was divided up into 5 parts by his 5 top generals. Each one of them took a piece. The parts were called Bactria, was the area that included the Persian Gulf area, portion of Mesopotamia, and the section of India which he conquered, together with some of Persia. Media, which was the ancient Persian Empire, also including Asia Minor. Egypt, which also included portions of the Sudan and Libya. Macedonia, that included Greece and anything else to the west. And Syria. The Syria is what we're interested in because Syria contained Palestine. It also contained an area to the south of Palestine which was called Idumea, and which shortly will become, the importance of my mentioning it will become clear to you. Idumea was in the south and Syria was in the north, and those two, together with Palestine and the Transjordan area, the area that we call Jordan today, that was Syria. It became the possession of a man named Nicator, who was the man in charge of the cavalry. Today he would have been the man in charge of the tanks, the tank divisions. He was in charge of the fast-moving group. He took over Syria. He took as his title Seleucus the First, and his descendants as a result were called the Seleucid family. So they became the royal family of Syria, Palestine, and that general area between Egypt and Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. It reminds one a bit of what Napoleon did in the last century. When Napoleon had conquered most all of Europe, he then parceled it out to his generals and to his relatives. and he intended to give his generals the countries round about France, and he intended to give his relatives the countries farther out. I think largely to get rid of his relatives, because they were, you know, they were always looking for something for themselves, and they were very jealous of one another. But anyway, this is what happened when Alexander died. And so the Seleucids were the ruling family of Syria. To the south of them in Egypt, the ruling family was the Ptolemies. And you've all heard of one of the Ptolemies who comes 3 centuries later, a young lady named Cleopatra, to whom we'll get in a little while. But within a century, the Jews were battling against the Seleucids to achieve freedom. And it took them until 164 BC. Now, from 312 BC to 164 BC, it took them until then to achieve their independence and to reestablish a Jewish independent state, the second Jewish independent state. The first one had been under Saul, David, Solomon, a few more kings, and then they had their troubles. Now, they had a free Jewish independent state, liberated by Judas Maccabeus and his family. And the Maccabean family now became the royal family of Palestine, which achieved independence from Syria. Now, it was the whole area south of modern-day Lebanon and Syria, which meant that it included Palestine, the area on the other side of the Jordan, and also Idumea to the south. That was Palestine. The Maccabean family retained control over Palestine until 63 BC. Their family name was not Maccabee, but their family name was Hasmonea. And so they were the Hasmonean dynasty. So there in Syria, we have the Seleucid royal family, and now we've got the Hasmonean royal family. And quite obviously, they're competing with one another to get control of, or to retain control of, Palestine. And so for the entire time that the Maccabeans have control of Palestine as a free country, there are constant efforts by Seleucids to get control of Palestine once again. In 63 BC, there were two competing royal families, one Macedonian Greek and one Jewish, for control of Palestine. And they seemed to be fairly equal in the legitimacy of their claims and in their military capacity, or possibly incapacity. And so consequently, they appealed to the leading Roman general at the time to come to Palestine and to decide who should have control. His name was Pompey. Pompey was one of three men who had led a triumvirate. Today we probably call it a coup, which overthrew the control of the city of Rome by the Roman Senate and replaced it by a sort of oligarchic rule. Pompey had been the brains and the leader, distinguished military general in Rome. His second in command was Julius Caesar, a man who was rather good at military affairs also, but who had not established himself yet. And what you always have to have, if you're going to have a successful coup, a very wealthy banker named Crassus, who then took over the taxing program of the country and got it in better shape. And Pompey then ruled. Julius Caesar was sent up north to see what he could find. He found a lot of Germans and Scandinavians and wrote a book which has been inflicted on high school sophomores ever since, you know, called The Gallic Wars. You know, begins with all of Gaul is divided into three parts, which told of his exploits. Well, at any rate, Pompey was pretty much at the height of his power when he was invited to Palestine to adjudicate this dispute about who should rule. When he got there, they began to act differently, and they began to gather their military forces together. Well, he obviously brought a group of Roman soldiers with him also. And so he found them, instead of sitting down around the bargaining table to discuss the situation like gentlemen, he found them preparing to fight against him. And so he fought them and defeated the one, and then he defeated the second one. He bottled the second one up in Jerusalem and laid siege and finally conquered the city and entered the temple and took over. And so the decision in the case was, the area belongs to Rome. So the arbitrator won. And Syria then became a Roman province in 63 BC. After Julius Caesar and Pompey had a falling out, Julius Caesar chased Pompey down to the toe of the boot of Italy, and then Pompey headed over to the Near East and finally ended up in Egypt. Julius Caesar pursued him down to Egypt, and Pompey was then slain by his supporters, and his head was brought to Julius Caesar in the hope by the Ptolemies arranges, and they hoped that this was going to give them inside track with Julius Caesar. At this time he also met Cleopatra. And his reaction was just the opposite. Well, at any rate, at this particular time, there were a couple of men in Palestine who were to become extremely important. The one man's name was Jonathan Hyrcanus, and he was a Hasmonean. He was from the Maccabee family. His great-grandfather had been named John Hyrcanus, who lived a century before. So this is contemporary of Julius Caesar. His good friend and advisor was an Idumean, a man from that country down south, Palestine, whose name was Antipater. Now, Antipater is always a problem because there are at least four Antipaters in about a century and a half in a particular family. Now, that's a little problem keeping them sorted out. Now, this is the second Antipater. He was the political advisor to Jonathan Hyrcanus, who was one of the aspirants to the Maccabean throne of Palestine. Idumea in the Old Testament is called Edom, E-D-O-M, and it is the land to the south of Palestine extending all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. It's an area which along the coastline is being developed by the Israelis today as a kind of French Riviera of Palestine. It's beautiful, white, sandy beaches and weather-like outside today. And they're developing one resort after another, transferring Miami Beach over to Palestine. And very near the coast, just like in the southern coast of France, are high mountains. And the Edomites lived up in the mountains and down on the coast. There was a great deal of copper mining and a great deal of silver mining and iron mining in the territory. Much of it had been developed by King Solomon, and that's the historical area of King Solomon's mines. So this is the land of Edom. They are descendants of Esau, the twin brother of Jacob, the one who was the legitimate heir to the name, from whose descendants Messiah would come. But he traded it for a bowl of pea soup, you remember. Well, not really pea soup, but it was lentil soup. But he traded it for a bowl of soup when he came in dehydrated and hungry after a hunting trip. Well, this is where his descendants lived. So they were relatives of the Jews. And for a long time, there was a great deal of strife between them. When Judas Maccabeus achieved freedom for Palestine, one of the early things which he did was pacify Idumea. You all know what pacify means, don't you? That means you go and conquer and you lay down martial law and you say, everybody's going to behave this way or we kill them. And now all those who want to be killed step forward. And then you say, see how happy everybody is? They all agree. That's pacify. Well, they took all the males and they circumcised them and made them true Jews, and they told everybody, from here on in, you're true Jews. And that was the end. There's nobody that is more pacified than a recently circumcised male. And so at any rate, from that time on, the Edomites were no longer independent. And they were Jews, but they were looked down on by the pure Jews up north. So they were treated kind of half Jews. Well, they had a family that had pretensions to glory. And it was the royal Idumean family. And from this royal Idumean family came Antipater. So Antipater is the first of a series of people, and in very short order you're going to start hearing some names that you recognize. But these are descendants of Esau. Okay, now I got to get up to my notes. Okay. Antipater was a political advisor to Hyrcanus. Antipater, the Idumean, is advisor to Hyrcanus, the Hasmonean. They both supported Julius Caesar against Pompey. That was a very risky thing to do because everybody figured Pompey was going to win. And he might very well have won if he had lost his head, literally, to his friends. But at any rate, they supported Julius Caesar against Pompey. And so as a result, when Julius Caesar became the first Caesar of Rome, became its dictator, he remembered his two friends in Palestine who had protected his flank when he was in Egypt, and he saw to it that they profited personally from this. Hyrcanus was made high priest, and sort of political, quasi-political leader of the Jewish people. In addition to this, something which both of these men considered more important, because they were politically very astute, they secured economic and political advantages for Jews around the world. Now, this was a time when commerce was really building up in the Mediterranean area. As a result of Alexander's spreading Hellenistic culture, a common language around the world, a great deal of trade between East and West had developed. And Jewish people had gotten heavily involved in international commerce and banking, even as many of them are today. Jews were to be found in large numbers in all of the great trading cities of the world. When Christ was born, the great intellectual center of Jewish learning and culture was not Jerusalem. It was Babylon, where 5 centuries before, the top thinkers, the top political leaders, the top educators, the top economists, you know, the cream of the crop of the Jewish culture had been taken to Babylon. They had been integrated into the state. They were not discriminated against. You know, after that initial little business with Daniel, you know, where Daniel was discriminated against because he was a Jew and native Babylonians didn't have the ear of the king and they tried to get rid of him, you know. Once this business was passed, Jews became very important in the Babylonian politics and Babylonian economy. So that when the Jewish prophets, the time of Cyrus the Great, began talking about going back and resettling the homeland, nobody wanted to go. And very few people did go. The people that went back were the common people, the business failures, the bums, the losers. But the people that had made a lot of money, the people that were politically important, the great thinkers, the great schools of Babylon, they didn't go back to Palestine. And so at the time of Christ, The great center of Jewish Talmudic learning was in Babylon. And there was the greatest rabbinical school, the Harvard of the Jewish people, was in Babylon. The second greatest Jewish intellectual center was in Alexandria, Egypt, where the great library was located. And there was a great colony there for several reasons. One, because the great learning center associated with the library was there. And number two, Alexandria controlled the Nile. And that was where goods were transshipped from ocean liners, their equivalent of ocean liners that plied the Mediterranean, to river boats that would go up the Nile. And so Alexandria was commercially important. Many Jews were living in Constantinople, which was the crossroads between the Mediterranean world and the Black Sea world, and the north shore of the Black Sea in those days, as it is today, was the wheat bowl of Europe. And so there were many Jews in Constantinople, and also in the international river cities of Western Asia Minor. Now, if you'll visualize Turkey, you know, sticking out, see, how are you going to see it? You'll see it sticking up sort of like that. And if you see a map of Turkey with all the rivers on it, you'll see about 8 or 10 rivers that flow out to the Mediterranean from east to west, and they go way back to the central plain, where all the opium poppies are grown today. So they were all big, deep rivers. And where you've got a big, deep river that goes way inland, you know, you've got commercial possibilities. And so on each one of these rivers, a great city would develop. These are the cities to which St. Paul went. And these are the cities to whom John wrote the early part of the book of Revelation, to the seven cities of Asia. Now, most of it's critical. These are the great river cities where goods would come and then be taken inland and transported almost as far as China. And so there were large Jewish settlements in each one of these cities. And so it was very natural that St. Paul and the other apostles would head to these great Jewish centers to bring the gospel and say, hey, the guy we've been waiting for, the Messiah, has come. So, there they were. And of course, there was a Jewish colony in Rome, and it was rapidly increasing in size as Rome became increasingly important politically and economically. That was very important to secure political and economic advantages for these Jews. And Antipater and Hyrcanus, by means of their friendship with Julius Caesar, were able to get preferential treatment for Jews around the world. After Julius Caesar was assassinated, these two politicians backed Cassius. Now, you remember, Brutus and Cassius were the leaders of a conspiracy against Julius Caesar. So they then backed the opposition. They figured that the conservative Republicans were going to win, because Brutus and Cassius, you know, were the Barry Goldwaters of their day. They were conservative Republicans. They were in favor of return to the old rule by the senatorial families. And so they backed Cassius in the civil war which followed the assassination of Julius Caesar. The other side was led by Mark Antony, a young military general. As it turned out, Mark Antony won, Brutus and Cassius lost, and also were killed. But when Mark Antony won, these two men switched over to Mark Antony and backed him. But then when he was opposed by the other military legions, who were backing a young man named Octavian, who was had been a distant relative of Julius Caesar, but had been legally adopted as his son and heir. When they backed Octavian, these two men switched sides, with the result that when Mark Antony was defeated in the naval battle off of Greece by Octavian and his navy and army, and when he and Cleopatra fled down to Egypt and then eventually committed suicide, Antipater and Hyrcanus were on the winning side. And so once again, they had backed the winner, and the Hasmonean and the Idumean destinies were protected. The Hasmonean royal house were bitterly resentful of the increasing influence of the Idumeans, particularly since Antipater was smarter than were any of the Hasmoneans, and who was really running the country. And so they succeeded in pulling off a coup and killing Antipater. But Octavian, whom you know better as Caesar Augustus, divided Palestine into four countries, and he gave two of them to Antipater's two sons in 37 BC. The one son's name was Phasael, the other son's name was Herod. And that's the first Herod that you know, one who later would be called Herod the Great. The Hasmonean family, the Maccabean family, didn't want Idumeans running the country. And so they managed to pull off a coup. They captured Phasael and got rid of him. They drove Herod out of the country, and Herod fled to Rome. When Augustus had established his power in 27 BC and had become the second Caesar, he made Herod king of all of Palestine. And Herod then ruled from 27 BC until 4 BC, near the end of 4 BC, when he died. This is the Herod the Great, whom we know as the Herod when Jesus was born. Not the Herod at the time Jesus died, but the Herod when Jesus was born. His palace was in Jerusalem. And while he was king, he rebuilt the temple. And so the temple was referred to as Herod's Temple. The temple had been ruined in the various civil wars, and also as a result of the incursions of Pompey when he conquered Jerusalem. Herod was very influential in securing Roman law and Roman protection for all Jews. He secured Jewish property from confiscation by the Roman government. In spite of that, the Jews all hated him because he was not a pure Jew. He was an Idumean. And there was constant intrigue going on at his court, efforts to overthrow him. For purely political reasons, he married the granddaughter of Hyrcanus, and her name was Mariamne. She conspired to have him thrown out and to have her sons made rulers instead. As a result of this, he found it necessary to execute many relatives. He recognized that old Jewish culture had it, and that if Palestine was to be a modern state, he was going to have to modernize her cities, improve her commercial possibilities, and get her involved in Hellenistic culture. And so he built many cities, one of them Caesarea, which he dedicated to Caesar Augustus. He modernized and improved the seaports, which even at best weren't too hot, even today in Palestine. And he introduced Hellenistic culture and Hellenistic ways into Palestine. Now, obviously, the Jews weren't too thrilled about this. This is importation of pagan culture. He was a cold-blooded ruler who jealously guarded his power. He executed Hyrcanus for intriguing against him. Hyrcanus was his wife's grandfather. He executed his wife, Mariamne, in 29 B.C., and her two sons, whom she had had by him, Alexander and Aristobulus. In the last months of his life, he executed the heir to the throne, Antipater. Now that's the third Antipater. Young man Antipater, who was his son by another wife, because word got around the palace that he had died, and Antipater started getting ready to be king. Well, he hadn't died yet, and he didn't particularly like that, so he had Antipater executed. He finally died, and we all, of course, know about how he killed the infants at Bethlehem. And knowing this man's career, you can understand why he responded so dramatically to the news that a king was born in Bethlehem, the promised king of the Jews. See, a legitimate king, not an Edomite. So you can see why he reacted the way he did, and why he had all of these little boys killed off in Bethlehem. Because killing opposition was nothing new for him, and that was how he had kept his throne. Now, one other little thing. He died in 4 B.C. He was succeeded by his sons, Archelaus, whom you know is referred to when Joseph and Mary come back from Egypt. They find out Archelaus is ruling in Judea and that he's as bad as his father, and so they head up to Galilee, and they go by Transjordan to go up to Galilee. They don't even go through Judea. Archelaus was ruling down in Judea, and Herod, whom this will be the Herod when Jesus dies, is ruling over Galilee and Perea, and Philip is ruling the rest of the area. During the course of his career, Herod the Great had 10 wives. And he had children by at least 5 of them. He killed off his first wife and her children. And he killed off the oldest child of the second wife, that was Antipater. And children of one marriage married children of another marriage, and grandchildren married aunts and uncles back in Hasmonean. A real mess. If you look at the family tree line, you'll see intermarriage all over the place among the Hasmoneans and Idumeans of these two families, and nobody ever amounted to anything from that. We have a little problem of dating the birth of Jesus, because we can't get all of our information to gel. Now, we don't have a great deal of information. Our sources of information are 3. One is the early chapters of the Gospels, particularly Matthew and Luke. Josephus's various histories of the Jewish people, and a few Roman records that are still around. These are our sole sources that would tell us when Jesus was born. The Bible is the only one that, you know, gives us fairly clear record of when he was born. The Bible tells us, number one, Jesus was born when Augustus was Caesar, right? Word comes out from Augustus Caesar that all the world is to be taxed. So we know that Jesus was born sometime between 27 B.C. and 14 A.D. because those are the years when Augustus was Caesar. So we got within that span. Okay. Number 2. Wise men came from the east to Herod's court. We know that's Herod the Great. And we know that Herod the Great died in the winter of 4 B.C. So that cuts us back from 14 A.D. to 4 B.C. So now we're between 27 B.C. and 4 B.C. Herod first became king in 37 B.C., was restored in 27 B.C. by Augustus, and he ruled until 4 B.C. The Bible also tells us that after an unspecified amount of time, but undoubtedly not many years, Joseph, who had taken Mary and Jesus to Egypt, returned, but he bypassed Judea because Archelaus was now king. And Archelaus ruled until about 6 A.D. And so you see, we're working with a narrower time span within which Jesus was born, or could have been born. Now Luke tells us that Quirinius was governor of Syria, and that there was a census for purposes of taxation. Now Josephus tells us that Quirinius did his first census of Syria in 6 or 7 AD, and that he was governor of Syria at the time, and that the Jews rebelled against this, and he had a lot of trouble. Now this doesn't fit, does it? Because we've got the birth of Jesus somewhere between 27 BC and 4 BC. And we can't go with 6 AD, can we? No, so either we got to say there's a mistake in the Bible, which we prefer not to say, or there's something else here that will make it explainable. From the Roman records, we know the following. Publius Sulpicius Quirinius, that was his full name, was governor of Syria from 6 AD to 9 AD. Usually they were governor for 2 years or 3 years. Sentius Saturninus was governor of Syria from 9 to 7 BC. Quintilius Varus was governor of Syria from 6 to 4 BC. And there is no record of who governed Syria from 4 BC to 6 AD. That's a blank spot. We know also from Roman records that Quirinius was twice the governor of Syria. Now the Bible does not say that Quirinius did a tax census. It says the taxing was done when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Very likely the taxing census was done in Palestine by Herod the Great, because he was bosom buddy of Augustus, of Caesar Augustus, and he was ruling Palestine, which was semi-autonomous at this time. And while in the Roman world it was customary to take people where you found them and to count heads in families, what was more important to the Jews was how big each tribe was. And since this was going to be a once and for only, you know, big full-time census, it could be understandable that in Palestine people went back to their traditional tribal territory to register. All right, now, when was Jesus born? Now, one other point. We know from ancient Egyptian records that every 14 years in Egypt, the Romans conducted a census. Okay, when was Jesus born? All of the data that we have tends to zero in on one particular year. And that year, you know, there's one year that will make all of our information consistent with itself. And that is the year 4 BC. And so, if this is the case, then what probably happened was Jesus was born about the middle of the year, where we generally think he was born, you know, closer to Holden Christmas than to our traditional Christmas, probably around the 25th of June. Well, he was probably born in the middle of the year, weather like this, and that Herod died near the end of that year. And Herod lived long enough to hear that a competitor for him had been born and to make an effort to stamp him out. And it is not impossible then also that the governor of Syria from 4 BC to 2 BC was Quirinius, serving his first term in Syria. And so in the middle of a struggle for power, jostling for position by highly corrupt, immoral politicians, the King of Kings slipped unobtrusively into the world in a very unstable country at a time of rather general poverty, when the attention of the world was focused upon all manner of events which they considered considerably more important than his birth. Carol will see you at 2, and we'll talk about his birth.